Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Live Like an Athlete, your very favorite podcast, of course. I'm Erin Sciarroni. I'm joined in studio by Big Herc, your other favorite. You're a favorite, right, Big Herc?
Absolutely. Number one.
That's right. And we've got a very special show for everybody today. Yeah. I know you're excited, Herc.
I know, but I'm going to call you out because this is funny. And they'll find it. We actually taped a recording. And Erin forgot to hit record, so I guess we didn't tape it. We did an opening without a record.
I did not forget to hit record. That was a technical malfunction. I did hit record. Everybody listening, this is about our third take. So forgive us for not being as witty as normal.
Is third time a charm?
Maybe third time works a charm. I really hope so.
In this instance?
Either that or it's three strikes, you're out, in which case I'm out after this one.
Then I got to start running the computers. See, this is what happens when you plan the podcast during lunch. We're not thinking straight, you know, we're emaciated, so...
We're emaciated. I don't speak for yourself. I wish I was emaciated, unfortunately.
All I keep dreaming about is a cheeseburger right now. I'm so hungry.
As long as it's a paleo cheeseburger.
That is true.
No bun. What did our guest say last week? No gluten, no carbs. But you could have the burger with the cheese and the bacon and the
good stuff.
And the avocado. That's good stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Fried onions.
Oh, yeah.
Mushrooms, sautéed mushrooms.
I get the, what was it, the avocado pulled pork or whatever we were.
Oh, that's right. Did you ever make that?
No, come on. I'm lazy, so.
Sorry, listeners, we digress. Yeah. But if you want to know what we're referring to, you can go ahead and listen to last week's podcast where everything was about delicious paleo food and Herc and I left very hungry.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we move on, I'm going to read our CYA disclaimer, which Herc has insinuated may or may not actually be a disclaimer. But basically, use your common sense, people.
Do you want like a drum roll?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I don't know if anyone heard that out there. I want to remind everybody listening that in no way, shape, or form should this be considered as medical advice, a substitute for a professional opinion. This is for your personal entertainment and edification only. If you don't know what edification is, please look it up in the Wiktionary. Please advise a physician before beginning any exercise program or making changes to your diet. Ta-da! Finished. Thank you. That's your closing drum roll.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
If anyone heard that.
So I can't call you Dr. Sciarroni?
No, not until I go to medical school.
Okay, all right.
Or chiropractic school or naturopathic school. Some sort of school where I can actually have some sort of certification. Moving along.
All right.
This week's theme, let's just get to it. Cut to the chase since we've already taped this once and nobody really knows what we were talking about previously. We're in the midst of playoffs and NBA and NHL playoffs. I figured the central theme here, really, that we haven't talked about yet is injuries, right? I mean, that's integral to the playoffs. You're playing at an elevated level.
Yep.
Likelihood for injuries, and it also affects the outcome pretty significantly in a pretty short period of time. You mentioned during our last take Russell Westbrook getting hurt last year and that, you know, sort of slashing their chances, and it happens. We see it all the time. But I thought it would be really cool to have a reprise of our very first guest, Mr. Matthew Uehara, pro strength and conditioning coach to the pro athlete stars. He's really one of the best in the biz. He's out there in LA. And if anyone knows about injuries and how to assess them in a unique way and how to prevent them and then how to treat them also in a unique way, it's Matt. And he's in the unique position in that the guys that he trains are pro athletes from across all the different leagues, and he sees them at various stages of their athletic careers or of their athletic season. So he sees these guys preseason. He sees them immediately postseason, whether that's following the playoffs or whether it's following a non-playoff run. He sees them in the offseason when they may or may not be less in shape and advises them on, you know, training, nutrition, all that stuff. So I was like, this guy would be great to talk to about looking at the NBA and NHL picture right now, assessing what's going on with these guys, what kind of risks are inherent to either sport, and then, you know, talking about cool ways to prevent and to treat injuries. And that's applicable to you people who are listening out there who are not pro athletes, and also to Herc and I who are not pro athletes.
We just pretend to be pro athletes.
Yeah. Herc has the biceps of a pro athlete. Though.
That's true. I'm doing my push-ups, so.
There you go. Me too. Probably way less than you, though. Without further ado, I would like to welcome back Matthew Uehara. Matt, thanks so much for being here, man.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Can I say something really quickly?
Yes.
Congratulations on all the success that this podcast is having. I think, for one, it speaks on the content that you're bringing your audience, and then two, that you know, people are really interested in health and wellness and trying to make a difference in their lives. So I think it's really cool that you guys are doing this, and congratulations on all the payoff for your hard work.
Oh, Matt, thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. By the way, we did not pay Matt to say that. Or to threaten him.
I still have my suspicions about you, Aaron. All right, you know, this, you get all this money from the companies that you promote. And
no, I don't. lies. Matt, in case anyone didn't listen to the first podcast that you were on, I'm going to read your bio, which is very impressive, just so folks listening now have an idea of who you are and what you do. Matt works with professional athletes from the NFL to the MLB. He has, including many names that are common household names. Matt has helped prepare numerous athletes for the Olympics, NFL, CFL, and UFL combine trials. He's also worked with athletes from the NBA, EuroLeague, NFL, PGA, MLB, ATP, and MMA for season and event preparation. So basically everybody. Matt is an Oregon Duck. He graduated from the University of Oregon with a master's in human movement. He is the founder and president of Hale Inu Strength and Conditioning, Inc. Hale Inu, Matt's Hawaiian. Hale Inu means doghouse in Hawaiian, so you understand his training style.
You pronounce that very well.
Thank you.
So,
I like to consider myself an honorary Hawaiian, as Matt knows. Matt's website is www.haleinusc.com. We'll put that up on the website. You can follow him on Twitter as well. He's lectured on many topics, including nutrient timing, warm-up, cool-down, recovery modalities, halftime optimization, neurobiomechanics of sprinting, weight training, movement training, energy systems development, reactive neuromuscular techniques, mental conditioning, injury prevention, and muscle energy techniques. Herc is clapping.
There you go.
Basically, Matt's really smart, and he's really accomplished.
Right. You're too kind.
Can I get the first question this week?
Go ahead, man.
All right. Matt, I got a question for you.
So yeah.
At the end of the regular season, we see a lot of teams rest their players, maybe for a game or two. Does that make a huge difference in your eyes?
I think from an injury prevention standpoint, it definitely does. Obviously, there's going to be some players that would want to play, and so that they don't get this kind of rust going. But in my eyes, I think it's very crucial if you're in a position to go into the playoffs and it's not really going to affect your standing too much, that you can rest your guys from a nervous system standpoint, but also the tissues need time to recover and repair. And we all know the NBA and NHL seasons are long, and not just the games that they're playing, but the practices that they have to go through as well. So all of these training sessions add up, and it's definitely a benefit if you can rest some of your guys, I think.
That's very interesting because, you know, I always wondered, is it going to matter one or two games? I mean, you know, because 4 days later, they got to just pick up right again. But, you know, any little thing, I guess, after just a long season, just even a good mental break is a nice little treat.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, this is the highest level, and you're trying to get any kind of advantage over your opponent. And so if you're just a little bit more recovered than they are, and I mean, I think it really does play into having an advantage in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, you see, for instance, you know, Coach Popovich doing this all the time with the Spurs, who obviously are extremely successful with their playoff runs. I mean, just the way that the Spurs work diligently, strategically. People say they're boring, but they are good. And as anyone who listens to the NBA picks with Matt Moore, and I know that I always pick them because I trust him. But kidding aside, Popovich does this in the regular season. What you're talking about is like, hey, strategically, it doesn't make sense for me to play Manu and Danny Green and Tony Parker. And so I'm just going to rest them, just not because they're injured, but because I want to preserve the integrity of their performance. Right, Matt?
Yeah, and I think more coaches should actually do that. I think it would prevent a lot of injuries, but it also will allow for them, you know, when we're practicing skills, because if you look at the entire season, you can look at it almost like practice for the playoffs. So when you want to teach skills and you want to teach movement patterns and all those kind of things, the more recovered the brain is, the easier you are, the easier you adapt to the stimulus. So by him resting his guys during the year, it allows for the team basically to be on a better page with each other. So in addition to that, he gets his backups playing a little bit more in more game-like situations. So when they go to the playoffs and, you know, God forbid there's an injury, that they could step up for that. But I do think more coaches in the leagues that allow it. So obviously the NFL couldn't allow that because there's only 16 games, but in the NFL, I mean, in the NBA and the NHL, MLB, they all have so many games there. I think that giving them a rest every once in a while is definitely crucial.
And you mentioned something really interesting there, Matt, about resting their brains, which I know we want to talk about the physical nature, because you deal with guys on a physical level manipulating their bodies, and we'll get to that. But that's interesting because we actually had a guest, the brain doc, Dr. Karasidis, who founded Excellent Brain Center, and we talked all about the brain. And so maybe you can just touch on that for a second, because people forget that it's not just the body, but it's the brain that needs flexibility and rest and recovery and rehabilitation and all that stuff.
Definitely. I mean, in order to do any type of voluntary action, you need to have some sort of signal coming down from the brain telling you to do that action. So if that's foggy, or if it's not fully optimized, then you're going to have these dysfunctional patterns. Or sometimes you'll have a pattern that tends to be a little bit lazy. And anytime these guys go through lazy patterning, they tend to get more susceptible to injuries. So anytime you can recover and anytime you can give the nervous system some time to adapt, then the output, which is movement, will be much cleaner. And so anytime you're teaching them new plays or new patterns, whether it be like how to squat or whatever, from a training perspective, you always want to take into account how ready they are to adapt to that stimulus. So that's why we talked about in the previous podcast that we always test them before their workouts to basically gauge their availability to adapt.
Matt, I wanted to ask you to change course a little bit to baseball.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed, but there was just a lot of pitchers going out with Tommy John, you know,
exactly,
damage in their elbow this year. And I've seen a few things about people say they blame it on youth development. They say these kids are not supposed to be throwing certain pitches at an age. And others say now when they get older, nicotine. They said these guys, nicotine doesn't help in the recovery, and they're blaming that. I just want to see, you know, maybe what your take is on it, and is there a way for these guys maybe to train their elbows in the off season so they don't have these problems?
Matt, I'm sure, does not advocate chewing that disgusting crap that they all spit into the dugout. It's so nasty. I don't understand it.
I mean, I haven't heard the nicotine end of things, but definitely from a youth standpoint, one of the things that we always talk about when we're dealing with youth development is to allow them to play multiple sports. I mean, these major league pitchers don't pitch all year round. So if these kids are playing in their summer leagues, they're playing with their travel teams, they're playing with their school teams, they're pitching year round, and they're basically incurring a lot more stress than even a major league pitcher would. Now, if you look at the reason why they're injuring their elbows, oftentimes it can move up the chain or down the chain too. So you can look at what's happening in the thorax or what's happening up in the shoulder, because if you don't have optimal mechanics there, then it's going to manifest itself out further in the distal portions like the elbow or the wrist. And so a lot of these pitchers who don't have great, whether it be stability or rotational components within the core or have optimal mechanics within the shoulder, it does tend to manifest itself down in that UCL region, that medial elbow region. And so definitely from the standpoint of the youth, we want them to get to recover a little bit more and play multiple sports and be free and be a kid rather than train them year round in the same sport and in the same motor patterns. But then up at the higher levels too, allowing them some time to recover after the season. And we won't have them pitch or even throw any kind of balls a month or two after the season's done. So we want to make sure that they're fully recovered before we get into any type of sport-specific type of training.
And that whole premise seems sort of inherently intuitive when you back up and think about it, because playing multiple sports is basically diversifying not only your movement patterns, but your neural patterns, as you just talked about, brain training, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of the same thing we would do with food. Like, you're not going to eat the exact same meal every single day, day in, day out, depending on what your diet is.
Sure.
Like, if you're paleo, you're not only going to eat steak and broccoli, right?
Sure.
Because then you become deficient in other things. So in my analogy in my head, at least for this, as you're talking, Matt, is to think about movement and human performance in the same way.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong, pitching is still very, very important for the little kids, because in order to be a major league pitcher, there are certain elements that you must have within your shoulder. Like the humerus has to torque in a certain way to allow some of that laxity. And obviously some people have more laxity within their ligaments genetically. But from a standpoint of throwing when you're younger, it is important. So it's still important to have that component within their training when they're young, but to allow for them to recover, just like you would allow a major league pitcher to recover between throwing sessions too. I mean, these kids are throwing way more often than they should be.
That's, you know, very interesting, because I've actually heard when they talk about soccer players, they said the good ones have the muscle fibers. They said it really comes down to them being elite players because they can, you know, their body just is developed for that sport, and they can take their game to another level that other players can't.
Sure. I mean, I would imagine, and this is probably the subject of a future podcast, that that genetics plays a role to an extent. Like, you're going to be predisposed and gravitate towards a particular sport, provided a parent isn't pushing you,
sure.
Right? But as a naturally, you're probably going to enjoy what you're best at, what your aptitude is for, and your aptitude is a combination of things, and it can be improved. But it's like I tell people, like, if you're tone deaf, you're not going to be a musician. Like, you can only improve so much if you're tone deaf. Seriously. But, I mean, it's a trait, right?
Sure,
but
absolutely.
If you're born with an innate ability to assess tone and an innate ability to understand and mimic rhythm, you have the potential to be a much greater musician, because, therefore, your scope of variability is wider. And
sure.
So I would assume that for various sports, there are certain things that people are genetically predisposed to, right? Fast twitch muscle fibers are going to be a sprinter versus
sure.
endurance and stuff like that. Is that right, Matt, or are we crazy?
No, you're absolutely right. Yes, muscle fiber is a huge component of it. But what we're even talking about, too, is that by training your sport when you're young, bones and other tissues surrounding that, too, adapt to allow for greater task accomplishment. So if I throw when I'm young, my humerus, or like my arm, is going to actually rotate in a certain way that will allow for more external rotation, which is why when you see these pitchers throw, they have some just crazy range of motion in their arms, but they can do that. Whereas me growing up, I didn't throw a lot of baseballs, I didn't throw a lot of things like that, so my humerus didn't have time to adapt in that way. So I will never, no matter how much I train now, be able to throw a 95 mile per hour fastball. So it is very important when they're young to be able to teach them to do those kind of things and to allow for those types of adaptations. But it cannot be overdone. And muscle does play a huge role in it. Like, some people are more predisposed to be great marathon runners as opposed to 100 meter sprinters. So that's definitely a component. But what's even greater of a component, I think, is the way that the bony adaptations occur when they're young.
Matt, a little bit about conditioning. You know, as you get older, you know, a lot of people like to run. But should they be doing other things than just besides running? Like, say, if they want to lose weight or something, will doing multiple exercises matter?
I'm a big anti-runner, FYI. Matt knows this.
Yeah. No, I agree 100% with Aaron that doing multiple things and not just running will allow for greater weight loss achievement. I mean, going in their weight room and being able to activate those higher threshold motor units, because that you're never going to touch those unless you pick up something heavy or you're doing something at a very, very high speed. So tension does enhance weight loss. So putting yourself under these loads. And another aspect of that too is that if they continue to run and they just do running, they tend to get these overuse type of injuries there. So when you are changing the stimulus, like, running's still important, but if you change the stimulus and have them go ahead and do some weight training or do some swimming, they'll have better results in the long run.
I can't remember the name of the study, and Matt, maybe you know of it. I read so many books that they like blur together. I don't know if it was in Dr. Volek's book about low carbohydrate performance, but at any rate, somebody did an actual study showing that over time, people who are long distance runners, like, that just run for exercise, you know, those people who are like, oh, I'm going on my 8 mile run, over time, the metabolism actually slows down and becomes less effective. And so something like every decade, you would have to add another 10 miles to your weekly run in order to create the same, quote, caloric deficit.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was just and I'm really doing a disservice now to the study because I don't have it in front of me, and I can't remember who said it, and I don't remember the details. But if you Google it, I'm sure you could find it. And I felt very vindicated because I'm, like I said, an anti-runner, partly because I have sprint genes and I hate running for that reason. But
can you buy those in the store, by the way?
It's very interesting.
So
no, it has nothing to do with the phone company, unfortunately. Yeah, I can.
No, that is interesting. I've never heard that before. That's interesting. I'll have to go ahead and look that up.
Yeah, I'll try and become more prepared for the next podcast, and I'll tell people what it actually is. But it was really interesting, and I was like, wow, you know. And it sort of made sense for the reasons that you like the analogy we made earlier. If you ate steak and eggs every single day for 30 years, you would be not in a very good place, even if the nutrient profile of your particular meal was correct. And so it's like not saying that running 5 miles a day is bad for you, but like if that's all that you do and you do it every single day and you do it till you're 50, you ain't going to see very good results.
And what about your knees? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, forget it. My knees are shut. I have like a Dwayne Wade knee in my right knee.
No, but yeah, you're absolutely right. The body, the way that we burn calories and stuff is to adapt to stressors, right? So not just the amount of calories you're burning during the session, but the amount that you're using to recover is extremely important. So if you give it the same stimulus over and over and over again, it's not that stressful to the body. So you need to have something that changes it up every once in a while that basically says, hey, this is a new stimulus that we need to recover from. Go ahead and try that out. And so that's another component that why not just running would be important for weight loss.
So that's actually a good segue into one of the listener questions.
All right.
Got a question on Facebook here from Eric Hernandez. Eric, thank you for always asking questions, by the way. This gentleman, I don't know him, but he always asks really good questions. So he has two. We'll ask you the first one because you sort of touched on it there, Matt. He said, what's your opinion on hyperbaric chambers to speed healing? And I think that's relevant to what we were just saying because, again, that's a different, very different, very intense stimuli that most human bodies are not experiencing on a daily basis. So, Matt, if you can explain quickly to people what a hyperbaric chamber is and what your opinion is on speeding healing with them.
Yeah, I do love hyperbaric chambers to speed healing. I mean, there are a lot of athletes that actually go out and buy some for themselves to have in their hotel rooms or their actual houses near the stadiums, and they get in them every night. I know that there's even some NFL players that won't sleep with their wives. They'll just sleep in the hyperbaric chamber overnight. So it definitely does help a lot. And what the hyperbaric chamber does is it basically gives an excess of oxygen, right, to the tissues. It oxygenates tissues. And that helps to clear a lot of that metabolic type of stress that you develop during the games or during training sessions. So that's extremely important there. Oxygen kind of acts almost as a buffer to the acid type of buildup that we get. And so a lot of guys report great recovery times and decreases in pain the next day. So I like that for that reason. I don't like it for the reason that a lot of people claim where this is like altitude type of training here, where we are spending this time in this hyperbaric chamber and it's going to get us to adapt to these different altitudes. And so when we go play our game, we're going to be in better shape. I don't like it for that reason because there hasn't been a lot of research that supports that. Training in altitude does benefit the athlete, but that's because they're living there 24/7. Spending, you know, 6-8 hours in a hyperbaric chamber a day and going back to normal altitudes is not going to be very beneficial.
Your body's so confused, it seems, about what environment are we living in.
Yeah, and it takes about like a couple of weeks to actually adapt to the altitude. So to actually get these types of adaptations that they're claiming. But if you are just going in it for a few hours per day, you're not going to get that type of benefit. But I do like it from the standpoint of recovery.
Well, cool, because that's what Eric was asking, was your opinion on it to speed healing, which it seems like you're an advocate of that.
Yeah.
And Matt, if a non-athlete, just regular guy, like, say, this gentleman, Eric, wanted to use it, what's your recommendation? I mean, I know that there are these expensive portable units, which may or may not be as effective as the real ones, but, like, how does somebody go about doing that? Like, where is it, or how do they go about using it?
Yeah, there are some doctors, I don't know where he's at, but there are some doctors that will have them in their offices that you can use. I mean, obviously, most of us aren't as well off as these guys that can just go ahead and buy them, or they don't get it sent to the team. So that's not a typical option for most people. So I would try and find a doctor nearby that tends to have one in his office. And there are some training centers that might have it too, but they tend to be like the real high-end training centers. It's a hard thing to get a hold of just because it's such a rare piece of equipment. I would say that there are other ways that you can facilitate healing that may be more cost effective. But it's a hard thing to get a hold of just because it is so rare and inexpensive.
And actually, that's Eric's second question, where he said, aside from proper warm-up program and hydration, what else can be done to prevent minor injuries? And I would add to that, to treat minor injuries that, you know, the rest of us would sustain. So you touched on that by saying there are more affordable, accessible options than hyperbaric chambers. So what would you say to that?
Well, to prevent injury, I would look at it more from this perspective. There's really only two ways that you can injure yourself. There's that neurobiomechanical model, and then in the second instance, we have this low capacity model. So the neurobiomechanical model, there's a great example of it in the NBA. It's Chris Paul. And in order to understand this, we kind of take a few steps back. We have to understand that we are asymmetrical beings who live in this asymmetrical world. In nature, we have these lemurs that tend to reach for food predominantly with their left hand. We have toads who are right forefoot dominant, and we even have whales that bottom feed primarily off of their right shoulders. Within our human body, we have a liver that is on the right side of the body where we don't have one on the left. We have a heart that's slightly oriented to the left, and we have a right lung that has three lobes where our left lung only has two. We have a diaphragm that connects stronger to the right side of the body and the spine than it does to the left. We have these eye and brain dominances as well. And these asymmetries bring about all these patterns of dysfunctional movement. So I'll give you an example. My dad is a doctor in Hilo, Hawaii. And when you walk into his office, you're greeted by this receptionist. And in order for the receptionist to greet the patient, she has to rotate her upper body to her left to look at her computer and the patient. Once you get past that and you go back into the checkup rooms, every single one of the six checkup rooms that he has there are oriented to the patient's left. When you go into my father's office for a consultation, his computer's to his left. In order for him to talk and consult with the patient, he has to rotate his upper body to the left as well. And these are not coincidences. These are normal human behaviors and patternings, and they're manifestations of these asymmetries. So we bring this back to kind of Chris Paul's injury here. He strained his right hamstring. Chris Paul's right hamstring strain, I don't know what it is, but most people that strain their right hamstring tend to have it on the lateral group of the hamstrings. Most people that tend to strain their left hamstring more, it tends to be more mid-belly to the medial hamstring, like the inside. And this is a neuromotor issue, meaning that the athlete has not been taught how to orient his body in a way that distributes these forces the way that it should. So in my opinion, in order to prevent injury, it's to teach them how to move correctly. And in this low capacity model, you know how we were talking about runners, we have sore knees and all this kind of stuff. There's a good example in the NHL with Tyson Berry. He sprained his MCL in a knee-to-knee collision with Matt Cook. And in training, our goal is to teach the body to withstand load. So when the load exceeds the capacity of the body, we have failures, i.e. like breaks or tears, et cetera. So this is a process that takes time to achieve. So my best advice to Eric is that first teach the body how to move, and then teach it to withstand that load by loading those patterns correctly. So that's more of the preventative standpoint of injury than it is to go in and facilitate recovery. Because facilitating recovery is dealing with basically making sure that you're fresh so that you can keep doing these patterns. But if you've never taught them the patterns to begin with, then they won't ever understand them.
Matt, I have a follow-up to that. Do you tell your athletes anything to do before they come into a workout? Because, like, usually, like, I don't know what to do myself. I don't know if I should eat something, if I should just spend, like, half an hour stretching to make sure I have enough energy to get through the workout. Is there anything like that, or you just tell them to be, you know, come prepared or don't eat, anything like that?
No, we do a lot before the workout. So, yes, we track whether they eat all their meals or not that day, and we want them to have had their meals up until that point. So whether it be they're coming in at lunchtime and they've had breakfast and a snack, or they come in early morning and they've had breakfast. So we like that. But then every single athlete gets their own basically formula. So we say that these are some of the exercises that put your body in a good position to succeed. And you're going to do them before we even start our session. So they can foam roll, they can do some lacrosse ball work. And then in addition to that, they have their corrective exercises, right? And then from there, we will load those patterns on a body that is now oriented correctly. But if we went and we just kept loading their patterns without this warm-up like you're talking about, then we tend to load dysfunctional patterns. And we don't like that because that leads to injury.
Is there a specific food that you recommend maybe if you like have a half hour before your workout to eat before you go in?
Yeah, so this is kind of the formula that I look at, is that the further away from your workout that you eat, the larger the meal is, and also the more solid the food will be. As you get closer to your workout, you want to move to a smaller meal and more liquid because it gets absorbed a little bit quicker. So if you're going to get something about a half an hour before, you might do something like a little protein shake with some, you know, some healthy fats in it. And that might be a good thing that would sustain you throughout the workout. During the workout, kind of the same thing. If the workout lasts longer than 2 hours, we want to have some sort of drink in there that contains some amino acids. But if the workout is less than 2 hours, we just want to have them drink water. But if they're trying to put on weight, we might want to add something with calories in it, like a coconut water.
Yeah, note to everybody listening who, like, you see these people going to the gym and they're like, oh, I got to have my my half my protein bar, my banana, or I got to, you know, slam my shake. Meanwhile, I'm like, first of all, not only are you not working out even remotely as close to how these athletes are being trained by Matt, and I've seen it firsthand,
sure. But
you're not working out more than 2 hours, most of you people, so stop eating during your workout. Like, also, one of our other guests, and Matt, you can corroborate this or not, Dr. Kate Shanahan, who I've introduced you to, so now you guys are friends.
Yeah.
She's the primal expert geneticist, and she actually advised me not to eat right before my workout, which I never really did anyway because it kind of made me feel crappy. But she said it's useless because unless you're severely like malnourished or you're an elite athlete, your body doesn't have enough time to do anything with that food. Her opinion is even if it is in liquid form, unless it's like, I guess, a really fast absorbing whey protein, which she doesn't promote. So that would be moot. But so what you said makes a lot of sense. And in fact, I switched over to using just algae and like spirulina tablets prior to my workout, which provides an immediate accessible source of oxygen and nitric oxide. So I feel the effect profoundly. But when I would eat or drink anything otherwise before my workout, first of all, you always struggle with what the heck you should possibly eat or drink. But then I just felt that it was always in my stomach, and I'm like, this is stupid. Not only do I not have more energy, but now my stomach is bloated, or now I have a cramp, or, you know, it just seemed really irrelevant. And her point was, unless you're in, you know, some genetic freak space, half an hour before your workout, your body ain't using that stuff while you're working out for 45 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love her points on that. And the one thing that I would say, though, is that everybody's individual, right? So there are some athletes that they just don't like eating before they come in because they feel, like you were saying, they either feel bloated or feel like they're going to throw up. And maybe it's the type of food that they're eating before. but also it might be that they're just not a person that needs that. The other side of things too, though, is that the stuff that you're taking in, you're not necessarily looking at it for fuel for the workout,
right,
but you're looking at it for preparing the body to recover following the workout. And so that's kind of a different view of things. But you know, also on that individualized kind of spectrum there, I work with this triathlete, and when she's in her races, her go-to is Coke. So she'll be running her races, and you know, they have these little pit stops there, and she drinks Coke, which is not what you would recommend for anybody, really, but that's what helps her, and that's what she feels that she needs to continue her race. So it is completely individualized, and we have Marshawn Lynch in the NFL who does his Skittles thing, and that's all great, but we just want to make sure that the rest of it, the nutrition, is sound.
Matt,
and we allow for those little, you know, discrepancies.
If you listen to last week's show, you know how much Aaron hates sugar, so.
If you listen to any show, Matt's my friend outside of this, so he knows. Matt hates sugar, too, although I'm more extreme about it. But you're right that everyone is individual and has individual needs. Doesn't mean that their individual needs are optimal, though. She may actually – I have no doubt in my mind that this triathlete really needs the Coke because she needs – the sugar fix, because she's not a fat burner, right? She's not in ketosis, first of all. So a lot we know from talking about the stuff and the science behind studying endurance athletes is the majority of them, like the majority of everybody in the first world, are sugar burners. And so your insulin and glucose control is not maximized. And so, yeah, you only have about 2,000 calories of glucose to burn through before you either need to replenish it or you pass out if you're not burning fat as fuel. And so, yeah, sure, that makes sense. Somebody might need that, but...
Yep. I mean, there's obviously other ways to get those sugars into the body.
Right.
But her go-to and what makes her in a better mental state to continue to compete is Coke. And that's completely fine. We let her do that. I mean, she's doing really well, and we don't want to mess with a good thing, basically.
Well, Godspeed, Coke lady. But all that aside, Matt, I think a bigger question here maybe we can address in the context of injury prevention and rehabilitation is just generally how does diet play a role? Because we talked last week about inflammation. Obviously, you're looking to reduce inflammation to maximize performance, particularly in light of the playoffs when you've been grinding a whole season. Now you're grinding really hard for a month and trying to win. And so, like you said, it's a really precarious situation. So how does diet overall play a role? Because you know my feelings about diet.
Yeah, I think there are two components to making sure that the athlete stays healthy during this long stretch. And they're both equally important, and they both play off of each other. One is making sure that they have a nice base and they understand how to move. And then the next side of things is that they have enough fuel to recover from these training sessions, because every single thing that they do is a training session. So I agree that nutrition is half the problem of most of these people. And one of the biggest parts of nutrition is if they have poor nutrition, they will have poor motor functioning. So if they don't eat properly, and say they get fatigued because they haven't ate properly, well, they're not going to be able to mentally be able to get into the patterns that they want to, and that leaves them more susceptible to injury. But in addition to that, you have the recovery from the training sessions. So if you're playing from a body that's not fully recovered, then again, you're more susceptible to injury. So definitely, and especially with these guys getting closer to playoffs and stuff, fats and proteins are going to be huge. And if it's in a sport that requires a lot of glycogen replenishment, some of the carbohydrates will be important too. So, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly that nutrition is a gigantic component in making sure that these guys stay healthy.
Matt, on a previous show, I pulled a story from the Wall Street Journal that said the University of Michigan basketball team, they chucked chocolate milk after their workouts.
Yep.
What's your take on that?
Matt heard how angry I got about that one. I don't care if the dairy industry hates me. I like raw milk, not garbage pasteurized crap with sugar and colorings in it.
Yeah, so the reason why they did that is there about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a study that compared chocolate milk to other recovery sports drinks, and you know, they even compared it to regular milk too. And what ended up finding is that the guys who had chocolate milk recovered a little bit better. And the reason behind that is because if you look at what chocolate milk contains, it contains your fats, your carbohydrates, and your proteins, right? Obviously, there are better ways to get that, and Aaron knows that. But what ends up happening is that these companies took this research and they were like, okay, well, let's go make some money off of this. And then they went and they created their own chocolate milk post-workout recovery drink. And that's why it's in a lot of schools now, because schools are so limited in what they can actually give their players in the NCAA. There's so many regulations, which I don't get, because they're training so hard. I think they should be able to, you know, like we had this thing with Shabazz Napier where he was complaining about being hungry. Yep. And, you know, all of these things factor in. And so oftentimes schools are forced to give their guys things like chocolate milk because they are so handcuffed in what they can give their guys.
Let's be clear about how people are handcuffed, okay? It's like you said it. You said it, Matt, and I was making mime gestures over here on the other end. It hurts. Try not to laugh at me. It's money. It's money.
It is.
Just like you said. They said, oh, well, let's take this research, like companies do all the time, and let's see how it translates into our pocketbooks.
Yep.
And by the way, I'm not speaking on behalf of the NCAA, but there are plenty of healthy available options, which may not be aligned with companies that are lining your pockets, that you can feed people. So this argument of like, oh, yeah, you know, Shabazz Napier is hungry and, you know, we're handcuffed in different ways so we can't feed him appropriately. Are you joking? The kid is probably hungry, A, because I guarantee his glucose level, his sugar, you know, if it is not out of control, then it is certainly not optimized, because most people's aren't.
Yeah.
And anyway, like, what's the problem with giving kids high-quality grass-fed meat, you know?
I don't think there's any problem with that. Yeah.
Right. It's a rhetorical question, but right. So that's why I get so furious about all this
stuff. Don't pick on my boy Shabazz. I'm a UConn man.
No, I love him. Good for him. But the poor thing is hungry. Matt just said he's hungry. Feed him, for God's sake. You give him a slice of pastured bacon, you know? I mean,
well, you even heard the NCAA president came out after a week later and said, he didn't say it correctly, but he said, I agree. I said,
yeah, and then they allowed them unlimited snacks. I'm like, oh, that's great. Now everyone can eat Doritos and watch the injury rate soar. I mean, come on, man. But really, all kidding aside, it's nutrition is certainly, like Matt said, at least 50% of the equation. And as to the chocolate milk point, what he also said but didn't say was it was on a relative basis. So they took the garbage they were already feeding them, which is sports drinks that shall remain nameless, comprised of corn syrup and citric acid and coloring. And then they compared it to more or less a slightly real food, which comprised of milk and cacao powder. Which do you think is going to have a less detrimental effect? I mean, it doesn't mean that it's good for you. It just means it's less bad for you.
Sure, sure.
Right?
See, I know how to push your buttons, though. So I get the Aaron push the button thing, and then boom.
Thanks, Herc. That's why I have you sitting here with me. I guess before we let you go, Matt, one more thing. We'll let you talk about the Red Wings, because I know how you ended up as a Hawaiian who is obsessed with the Detroit Red Wings. I do not know. I asked Matt that. I'm like, Red Wings? What? He said, did you see my Red Wings? They got a win. I'm like, you're from Hilo, Hawaii.
Hey, winners pick winners, all right? Don't forget that.
Right. So that was his explanation, I guess, from the time he was a kid, though. So, Matt, I saw a tweet the other day, and somebody said, Red Wings captain Henrik Zetterberg said he feels good after the first real practice. He has to be smart about his possible return day to day. And they're talking about that in the context of the playoffs, of course. And so if you're working with somebody like that, you know, who's critical to a team in the NHL in particular, and like you said, these guys grind super hard, and you've got to be strategic if you want to make a deep run. What do you do as the trainer or the coach?
Yeah, I mean, there is, if you look at movement, there is a prerequisite to every single movement that we have to do. And so it's the job of the training staff to ensure that these athletes have these prerequisites to withstand the training sessions or the games that they're going to go through. If you are working with somebody like that, it is crucial to the team. Obviously, the player is going to have a big input into whether he feels ready or not. And then you're going to go through your little evaluations and you're going to consult with the team docs and see whether you have to get in the way of the player and tell them, no, we're going to shut this down, or if the player is ready to do it. And obviously when he's on the ice, you have to monitor him. So I wouldn't throw him back into playing the complete game right off the bat. I would play him in sporadic minutes, but that's more of like the coaching aspect of things. But yeah, the coach and the docs and the trainers have to be on the same page in allowing this athlete to come back healthy and then come back in a way that won't ruin his career in the future. So they have to have a bigger picture view on things and not just look at it as this is the only series that matters.
Unless, I guess, you're between a rock and a hard place.
I mean, yeah, they're in a tough situation right now, but yeah, I would definitely help bring this out. I mean, the goal is to get them on the ice, right? And we all want that, and he wants that too. But oftentimes players, and you know, our us as human beings too, we're not our best judge. We don't use our best judgment in coming back. You know, sometimes we'll go into the weight room and be a little achy and go ahead and lift right through it and end up being on our IR for a month. So it's crucial that the training staff, if they need to, get in the way of the player, because the player is going to want to play.
Yeah, we see that happen all the time. NFL, for sure.
Yeah. Especially with the concussion stuff, yeah.
Right, because you might, in the case of a concussion, you might like feel like you're okay to go, but as we know from talking to the brain doc last week, getting a concussion on top of a concussion is like 100 times worse.
Yeah, completely. I mean, and I think it's such a good thing that the NFL is implementing a more strict concussion policy. I mean, it's definitely a big step, and I know they're going to continue to do research on that end, but yeah, I think that should be the case for all injuries, right? You have to pass these certain tests before we allow you to come back onto the ice or the field or the court.
For sure. Oh, man. Good stuff as always, Matt Herc. Is he not the smartest person that you've ever heard speak on this matter?
Every time Matt comes on, it's an interesting podcast, and we got 10 questions left, and we, you know, run out of time here, but it's just awesome, awesome banter.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, Matt. You are the best. Before we let you go, you gave us a really good recommendation last time that we had you on, but I guess maybe your top 1 to 3 things, what do you suggest that people do in order, us non-athletes out there, we can take this information to the gym or the marathon or whatever, in terms of preventing injury and rehabilitation?
Yeah, so we'll go through 3 of them. One is the nutrition, right? So we talked a lot about that today, and making sure that we take in the right fuel. And we all understand that that's important from not just that training session, but in the recovery phase as well. The second thing I would say is to work on your weaknesses. We are great at working on our strengths. And if we continue to do that, we build upon these asymmetries like we were talking about before. But if you know that we have weaknesses, iron them out, and it'll make you a better athlete overall, but it'll also prevent injury too, because the two go hand in hand. And then the third is that make sure that you load yourself correctly. So once you are moving well, you use enough weight, you use enough volume, and you train those patterns well and extensively that you're able to adapt to many different situations. So let's say I'm out running and I step on a rock and I twist my ankle. Well, how do I get out of that position? I have to understand that. And if I haven't gone through the right training, then I will leave myself more likely to injury.
Sort of like the Chris Paul syndrome that you were talking about.
Exactly.
Poor CP3. We love you. We hope you get better soon.
Yeah. But big thing is work on
ego, so I can't admit I have weaknesses, so.
Herc will remain perpetually stuck in a pattern of pain.
Yeah, it's huge to work on your weaknesses, and I'm terrible at it because I know that it's not fun, and you know, you have to swallow your pride a lot of times, but it's crucial to having great performances as well as preventing injury.
Yeah, I would know. Matt had me crawling on the floor like a baby the last time we worked together. So all ego goes out the window with this guy. Matt, thank you so much. You were phenomenal, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And everybody listening, listen, you can ask Matt more questions on Twitter, because I've demanded of him that he become more Twitter active. His Twitter handle is at Haleinu. That's HALEINUSC for strength and conditioning. And his website is www.haleinusc.com. So you can Google that. You can also find it when we post the podcast with the little write-up on CBSSports.com. And I am sure that if you drop Matt a line, he will answer you as best he can. He may answer in scientific terms that you don't understand, but yeah, we can't help you.
He
with
only
that.
Can do it in 140 characters, though. So
that's true. He has to limit himself, unless he'll probably send you like multiple tweets.
Yeah.
Matt, thank you.
Thank you for having me, and it was a pleasure being on.
Always. Good luck with all your guys in the off season, and we'll have you back on soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Herc, Matt is the best.
I mean, it's awesome. I learned so much about stuff I was doing wrong before my workouts that I may never try again. I may just do something different and see how it works.
And, I mean, don't drink chocolate milk, whatever you do. At least not after a workout.
It was Taco Bell, so, you know, maybe I'll just stop doing the Taco Bell. I thought that was good energy, so.
Taco Bell has some, you can make Taco Bell healthy. They have, like, salad bowls,
sure,
and stuff,
yeah,
you know. I just advise against the tortilla chips. It's like Chipotle.
Yeah.
People say it differently. I eat their stuff, and yeah, it's good. It's non-GMO. And
as my entrepreneurship professor tells us, he loves to use them as a good business example.
They're great.
Happy chickens. That's what he calls it.
Well, their marketing is great too, because look at what your business professor is saying.
Yeah.
So using them as a case study obviously means they're doing something right. But kidding aside, yeah, no, I mean, listen, there's options everywhere, I think, especially in light of what Matt was saying, you know, in terms of eating smart and eating healthy, but customizing it individually for each individual person's needs. But I thought he gave us some really great advice in terms of, like, you know, how to move, teaching your body to withstand maximal load, mm-hmm, all that sort of stuff that we don't necessarily, like, back up and think about it that way when we're thinking about starting a new workout routine or completing a triathlon, just as an average person,
yes,
no matter what your state of fitness. We're not pro athletes, so.
we only pretend to be in our minds.
We only pretend to be. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the podcast, live like an athlete.
Yeah,
people want to live like an athlete.
Yes, absolutely.
We all think that we're better than we really are.
Yeah.
Right?
You know what I found the most interesting? I found out when we were talking about youth athletes, and Matt was saying he could train until he turns blue in the face, and he'll never be able to throw a 95-mile-per fastball, mm-hmm, because he didn't do it as an adolescent. It just makes me think of, do you know who Bartolo Colon is, the Mets pitcher?
Sure,
he's what, 300?
Mets pitcher. I'm from Queens. The reason I don't even like baseball is because I was subjected to the Mets my entire life.
I'm a Mets fan.
I had to be a Mets fan. You're a Mets fan?
I'm a Mets fan.
Welcome to the misery club.
I know. That's the whole point. If we win, I don't know what to do, because all we know how to do is commiserate.
Is lose. And, right, and be miserable. I always joke, I'm like, the last time that a baseball team I actually cared about, a.k.a. the Mets, won anything, I was, like, in diapers.
Yeah.
You know?
But anyway, just about Bartolo, I mean, he's definitely not living like an athlete. He looks like he's living like, you know, me at the Taco Bell. But he can throw heat. And it's just because, I guess, he did it when he was younger. And that was something I didn't know about. And I thought it was very interesting. So,
yeah, it was a really good question you asked about the pitchers. Especially when Matt started talking about, like, the laxity of the ligaments and them getting those crazy angles. I always think that I'm like, God, you ever watch a GIF or a picture in slow motion and you go,
yes,
how on earth? It's like watching the Olympic gymnasts, you know? You're like, I mean, yeah, NBA players and NHL players, they do crazy stuff all the time that maybe isn't as obvious to us in terms of, like, motor patterns. But when you see the range of bizarre motion that a pitcher has or that a gymnast has or a ballet dancer, and they do these, like, contortionist type things, and you're like, how are you doing this day in and day out and not hurting yourself?
Absolutely.
And so that was really interesting that he was saying it was not just about the patterning and the laxity of the muscles and the like, you know, the ability to be flexible, but also what I didn't know was the way that the bone grows. And he's talking about developing that in youth. And that was really interesting, because that's like Well, if you thought you were going to become a major league pitcher at the age of 20 and you never played, you're wrong.
Oh, there goes that pipe dream.
Sorry, Herc.
I know.
Although you could probably play for the Mets.
No, I'd rather go back and be 20, so, you know.
No, come on. Life gets better as you get older.
But and there's another thing with the altitude. I mean, altitude is no joke. The quick story is when I was a senior in high school, I was thinking about going out to school in Colorado. And so we started hiking on this trail. I mean, even just going up a hill, I mean, you just can tell if you're not used to that environment. So, like he's saying, if you don't live in the environment, you know, these barometric changes may not be a huge advantage if that's what you think it's going to give you. So.
Oh, yeah, but case in point, actually, and I wish I'd brought this up while Matt was on because it was really funny. I was out in L.A. the week before last, and paid a visit to Matt to say hello, and he's got dogs. He likes to take him out on hikes, and I thought, hey, beautiful day out in L.A. I'm flying out later tonight. Why don't we make use of the time, and let's go on a hike in Runyon Canyon. You know, you hike up, you can see the Hollywood sign.
Right.
Everybody, it's a very busy hiking.
I've seen it on TV.
Yeah, yeah, everyone goes. You see it in the tabloids, celebrity so-and-so's with his trainer on Runyon Canyon. I'm like, cool, I've never done that. That'll be fun. I consider myself, like, in good shape. I mean, I work out every day.
Sure.
You know, so in my mind, I'm like, all right, cool. I'm no athlete, but I'm, you know, more in shape than most people.
And Matt lapped you, right? I mean,
dude,
he left you in the dust.
Forget Matt lapping. Matt is a pro trainer, so he's, like, an athlete. But I start walking. I get halfway up this hill, and it's elevation somewhat, yeah. I guess. Right? I don't know what the elevation is. His dog, who's like 15 years old and had cancer, okay, is doing better than me. And I'm like, oh, Matt, oh, Matt, hold on. Because, you know, you're walking with a friend, so you're chatting and yeah. You're walking at a good speed. Meanwhile, there are like these fat people walking way faster than me. Old people, fat people, dogs, babies, toddlers. Everybody's going past Sharoni on this thing. And I was so mortified. So you talk about leaving your ego at the door. I was like, Matt, I didn't even want to, because I looked like I was tired, and I'm like, this is embarrassing. This person is 200 pounds more than me, and they're walking 10 times as fast as me. What's going on? And, you know, we joked about it, and it's actually just, it falls into that discussion of the conditioning of the motor patterns and, like, getting used to something. There are people who live there who go on that hike every day, twice a week, even once a week. You know, and he said, like, Aaron, you know, if you moved here and you did this a couple times a week or you were out here for a week or two, by the end of this first, second week, you'd be adapted and this wouldn't be hard. But because it was something new and like he was saying, you should constantly challenge yourself. The next day, I could not sit down.
You were so sore.
I will not go into specifics, but I could not sit down. Okay? It was an uphill walk. I texted Matt. I'm like, Matt, can't sit down. Didn't know those muscles existed. From one little Runyon Canyon hike, and anyone listening who's done that hike and not had a problem with this probably thinking, oh my God, what a loser. She can't even hike up Runyon Canyon. But I never do that sort of stuff.
There's no elevation down here in Florida. So
no, we're in a swamp.
Absolutely.
I mean, I surf, I paddle around, you know, I do my workouts in the gym, but I'm on flat land. I'm not walking up any hills.
Altitude is no joke.
No, it's not. So to that point, and so when people joke about, you know, oh yeah, so-and-so is going to go play in Denver today, whether it's you're playing the Nuggets, you're playing the Broncos. Yeah. That actually is a significant factor.
Absolutely.
Like it was interesting to hear him say that you actually can't really train for that other than being there, because you think, oh, these guys can train sporadically. You can train a hyperbaric chamber. You can train with masks on. People do that. All sorts of, unless you're living it day in, day out, I guess it doesn't really do much.
Yeah, your body is not adapting. Your body's like, what's going on here? So
really interesting, right?
Absolutely.
We should all go be Sherpas in the Himalayan mountains.
We're gonna go live in caves again.
I don't know. I always wanted to be a Sherpa. Don't you think it'd be fun?
I don't know.
Actually, no, it wouldn't be fun.
I don't think so.
It would be pretty.
Yeah, there you go. That's true.
It would be epic.
Each to their own, right?
To each his own. Yeah, I guess so. But okay, that's another good example though. Those Sherpas are not only do they. We should talk about that one episode. Because not only do the Sherpas like live there.
Oh, we got the Sherpa episode coming up.
We got to have a Sherpa on, or a Sherpa trainer, or a Sherpa guru, or something. Because those dudes are like born genetically. You know, there are Sherpa families that live there. So I feel like they're born like predisposed to being able to maximize their VO2 or whatever the biological thing that happens is. I'm not.
I think you just want to say Sherpa for a whole episode.
I want to say Sherpa.
Sherpa.
It's like
Sherpa.
That Seinfeld episode where they say salsa.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Sherpa.
Sherpa. That's going to be my new hashtag on Twitter. Sherpa.
Hashtag Sharoni Sherpa.
Sharoni there we Sherpa. Go. Oh, my God. Yeah. High five.
High five.
Don't fall out of your chair.
I know.
This
we
time.
Don't want to bleep that one.
Perk, we have way too much fun for people not being able to see us.
Exactly.
We need to be videotaped doing this.
Probably. I mean, it would be great, you know, and side by side. Like, I'm over here, like, 5 feet away, but I'm on one side and you're on the other side.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
Well.
Well, I don't think we can top the Sharoni Sherpa to go off a show.
No, we need to. I may start a Twitter handle, Sharoni Sherpa.
There we go.
Right? What would I be carrying? Oh, God, this could go so far and so wrong in so many ways so quickly.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in.
Well, I guess that's it, right, Herc? You got anything else?
No. Again, Matt, you know, glad you brought him back. I mean, it was fun. He answered all our questions. So
he's so good. He's the best. Remember, everybody. Go check Matt out on Twitter and on well, I would say on Facebook. He's not on Facebook, actually. Matt is allergic to social media. But you can check out his website. It's really great. If you're in L.A., you can actually go train with him. He is an amazing human being and an even better trainer. So that's saying a lot. Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember to drop us a line at likeanathlete@cbsi.com with questions and ideas for future shows. You can also follow us both on Twitter and tweet us with questions, ideas. I'm at Aaron Sharoni, and Herc is at CBS Herc. You can also ask him for fantasy advice, but I digress.
I give all types of advice.
Life advice. Yes. Herc will give you marriage advice, sex advice. Just don't hold him accountable. And please subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. If you're on Android, you can get it on Stitcher. We will love you forever.
Absolutely.
Till next time, friends. Have a good weekend.